Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekday mornings at 9 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
I'm Carrie Miller, and you're listening to NPR News. We've been listening to special coverage from NPR and to President Trump's remarks about the shootings and about what Congress ought to do next. If you listen to that statement, you heard the president using terms like evil attacks, wicked man, twisted monster, barbaric slaughters, evil contagion. The president declared that hate has no place in America. He talked about dangerous avenues to dangerous minds with the role that the internet plays in sites like 8chan. He talked about mental illness pulling the trigger, not the gun. And towards the end of his statement, he discussed telling the DOJ that they can commit hate crimes and to enforce the death penalty for these kinds of crimes. To recap where we are this morning, the citizens of Gilroy, California, had been mourning their dead from a July 28th shooting at a festival in which three children were killed when two more shootings took place this weekend, first in El Paso, Texas, and then hours later in Dayton, Ohio. Here's the mayor of Dayton, Nan Whaley.
Well, look, as a mayor, this is a day that we all dread happening. And certainly what's very sad is I've gotten messages from cities across the country is that so many of us have gone through it. Today is the 250th mass shooting in America. It's sad that it's in the city of Dayton.
Ohio Governor Mike DeWine was speaking at a vigil over the weekend to mourn the dead when families began chanting, "Do something." Now we've heard what President Trump wants to do. As we turn to our guest, I'm inviting you into the conversation this morning as well. As the mayor of Dayton noted, America has endured 250 mass shootings this year. Does this series of shootings, these most recent shootings, feel different? Are we at some kind of watershed moment in America where something must change? Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. You can reach me on Twitter, at CarrieNPR. Again, as I'm noting, and as politicians and community members around the country are noting, America has now endured 250 mass shootings in 2019 alone. Does this series of shootings over the weekend and in late July feel different? Are we at some kind of watershed moment in America where something has to change? 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter at CarrieNPR. Paul Barrett is with us. He's the deputy director of NYU's Stern Center for Business and Human Rights. He's the author of Glock, The Rise of America's Gun. And he's with us today from New York City. And Paul, welcome back to the show. It's always good to talk to you. Thank you for being with us this morning.
I appreciate the invitation.
I'd like to know your thoughts about some of the language that the president used. I went over a bit of it. Twisted monster, outraged and sickened, mental illness pulls the trigger, not the gun. Just your impression of that.
Well, I think the president was trying to shift our attention to a moral view of what's going on. And perhaps a perspective that says, in the end, there's a lot of evil in the world and there's not much we can do about it. So I would say that would have been the possible motivation for that list of highly florid, morally oriented terms. And of course, it was much more than you said. He really went overboard.
He talked about red flag laws. I think it'd be valuable if you could explain what these laws are and why they're only in place in a few states.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. That was the one area where President Trump was really clear and straightforward in endorsing a policy direction. Red flag laws which actually are in place in 15 states, so it's more than a handful.
Okay.
provide a procedure for family members or law enforcement to go and get a special court order that instructs the police to go to the home of someone who is deemed to be not well or otherwise a threat to the community, and to take their firearms away temporarily. So it's not a permanent confiscation in most cases, but a way to separate people who are thought to be a danger to themselves and to others from their arsenal of firearms.
You know, I remember this being discussed after the shooting at the Florida high school at Parkland. And indeed, there has been some gun control legislation passed in Florida. Was a red flag law among them?
That's a good question. I don't know offhand whether Florida is among the 15. So
okay.
I'd have to look that
we
up.
We can do some quick research on this. But overall, right, in Florida, the legislature went into session. The governor supported some gun control legislation. How unusual is that?
Well, since Parkland, there actually has been something of a trend at the state level, where you have about half the states passed laws that in one way or another tightened rules applying either to access to firearms, how you obtain them in the first place, or the possession of firearms. So we actually have seen, I'm not sure you'd call it a movement, but you've seen distinct activity at the state level, and that's in contrast to a lack of activity at the federal level.
And what do you account for that?
Well, I think you can attribute that to popular outrage over these mass shooting incidents that have become painfully common in our country, and that outrage translates into pressure on state lawmakers who have moved. Of course, there are a number of states where this is much less of a heavy lift for lawmakers. In blue states, have had state level gun restrictions for some years. I mean, California, New York, Massachusetts, Connecticut. But that tendency has broadened in the last couple of years, and particularly since the shooting you referred to in February 2018 in Florida.
We missed a call here from Mark in Minnetonka, but he's speaking about something that I wanted to talk to you about. He called to say, I feel like the best solution is to ban all military-style weapons. Civilians don't need them. I wanted to ask you, Paul, about some of the specifics on the weapons that were used in Dayton, Ohio. The shooter used a .223 caliber high-capacity rifle with a 100-round drum magazine. Will you describe how a weapon like that operates, and are they easily available?
The basic mechanism there is that you can fire many rounds, in this case 100 rounds, before you have to reload. Reloading is the moment when a shooter, no matter what type of shooter you're talking about, a soldier on the battlefield, a mass killer in downtown district of a city, the moment when the shooter is vulnerable to being overtaken or stopped. So if you can attach a large capacity magazine, the bullet holder, to a firearm that is easily fired very quickly, you are much more lethal. You are more capable of bringing down more victims.
Just to be simplistic about this,
yeah,
you can fire more bullets at a time without having to reload. Is it as simple as that?
That's the key distinction. If you have a firearm that has a 30-round magazine, you can fire 30 times and potentially hit 30 people in a crowded space, as opposed to if you are restricted to a 10-round magazine, you would have to reload after shooting 10 rounds. So it's not that magazine capacity is a magical limitation. It doesn't necessarily do away with mass shootings altogether, but it makes the mass shooter less lethal.
Okay. We have a call about this from Kurt in Slayton. Hi, Kurt. What do you want to know?
I think to see is some control on ammunition. If I go in and I try to buy multiple boxes of Sudafed, I can't do that. Eventually, the DEA is going to be knocking on my door asking what's going on. But people can go in and literally buy thousands of rounds of ammunition, no question asked. I'd like to see is a limit.
Okay.
15 rounds. That's all you can buy. We don't need gun control. People can buy guns, but if they go to a range, they can buy all the rounds they want at the range. They have to fire them at the range, and they go home with an empty gun. They keep their 15 rounds at home. If their ammunition degrades for some reason and they need to go in and buy more, they can replace it, but they have to bring that in. Or if for some reason they fired their gun somewhere besides at a safe range.
Okay. Kurt, I think we have
a police report.
I think we have the essence of that. Should we be focusing, Paul, given legislative paralysis in Washington, more on the ammunition and less on the actual gun?
It's an idea that's been raised. There are a lot of creative ideas. I don't think limiting people to 15 rounds would be particularly practical, since a lot of law-abiding gun owners would use much more than that when they go to the range or use the gun in a competition or something along those lines. But limiting people, preventing people from being able to acquire an open-ended number of rounds is a creative idea. The problem is that the NRA and its affiliates and its allies would oppose it fiercely, saying that people need to be able to arm themselves against intruders, against the tyrannical government, et cetera. Those would be the kinds of arguments you would hear.
Paul Barrett is with us this morning. He's the deputy director of NYU's Stern Center for Business and Human Rights, and he's the author of Glock, The Rise of America's Guns. He's with us today after having listened to President Trump's statement and taken in, of course, the details about a weekend of mass shootings and violence in America. As the mayor of Dayton, Ohio noted, we have now endured 250 mass shootings in 2019. I had to double check that number this morning. I thought it had to be over the period of several years. No, it is just in 2019. And so having listened to what President Trump said about this, having observed what goes on in Congress and in individual state legislatures, we've asked Paul to come in to take your calls and questions and mine about what may happen next, about restrictions, regulations on guns and ammunition, whether more reform or not is happening at state legislatures. How are we different? This is something else I've asked Paul about, and I'd like you to reflect on. How are we different in the wake of the shootings at the high school in Florida, in Parkland, Florida, because that ignited a lot of activism about gun reform? Has anything really changed beyond the state of Florida? And then your thoughts about this. Does this series of shootings feel different to you? Are we at some kind of watershed moment? Is our attention paid for a couple of days? And then we go back somewhat numbed and somewhat accepting of what goes on. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and on Twitter at CarrieMPR. Mark says on Twitter, semi-automatic weapons can shoot 3 to 5 rounds a second. That's why a mass shooter can kill and harm so many people in less than a minute. That is a crazy level of firepower for the average citizen to have access to. Paul, what is, when it comes to these military grade weapons, where are the restrictions about access to these kinds of weapons, specifically the military grade ones?
Yeah, well, there are so-called bans or laws that restrict the ownership of military style semi-automatic rifles in 7 states and the District of Columbia. Beyond that, there are basically aren't restrictions other than the general restrictions that apply to firearms, in general, meaning that if you can go into a gun shop or go to a gun show on the weekend and you can pass the background check, you can walk away with your very own so-called assault rifle.
Wow. And how strict are the background checks? Because we hear about loopholes all the time.
Well, the loophole you hear about the most is the one that applies to so-called private sales.
Okay.
Any time a federally licensed dealer sells a firearm, the dealer has to perform the background check, which means basically plugging the customer's specs into a federal computer system that looks to see whether he is a convicted felon, whether, you know, there's a court order out against him, whether he's, you know, been classified as, you know, adjudicated to be a danger to society, and a whole series of other disqualifying characteristics. And if none of those things come up, the sale goes through. Now, speaking of, you know, what can change, what can happen, the ripple effects of the Florida school mass shooting that you referred to did reach Congress. And this year, for the first time, on this question of background checks, the House of Representatives has passed an expansion of the background check rule so that it would apply to private purchases, as what meaning between you and me, as opposed to if I go to a gun store, as well as sales by federally licensed dealers. Moreover, the House passed a second bill that would extend to at least 10 days the amount of time that dealers must wait for the government to respond before completing a sale. Currently, if I go into a gun store and the firearm dealer runs my information past the federal government, but for some reason the federal government is having a slow day or the computers are down, and 3 days passed, I can come back and get my firearm, complete the purchase, whether the federal government has issued a determination on me or not.
Wow. It's like a ticking clock, and if the federal government does not weigh in, then the onus is back to the sale, the person that wants the gun. I noted that I think you said both of those pieces of legislation passed in the House. Did I hear that right? Never ended up being on the floor of the Senate, and of course have not been signed into law by the president.
That's right. Okay. And, you know, Mitch McConnell has simply stymied the legislation. It's not that there was a debate in the Senate and democracy worked its way and, you know, there was a resolution. It's just that the bills just have not come up, and therefore President Trump has not faced the choice of having to sign them or not. But the important thing, I think, to stress here is that there is legislation all teed up and passed in one House of Congress.
Yes.
So that if the president and his ally, Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, were serious about wanting to pass laws, which, by the way, are incremental laws. These are not laws that would ban categories of firearms or probably even necessarily prevent mass shootings. They would prevent, you know, some criminals from getting a hold of some weapons at some point. But there are options on the table if the president is serious about moving forward.
Okay. Call here from Nancy in Bemidji. Hi, Nancy. What are you thinking about this?
Okay. So I honestly thought that the watershed would be the 20 first graders killed way back.
Nancy, I am so sorry, but your phone is cutting out, and even I can't hear. I think you said you thought the watershed was going to be at another one of these mass shootings. Did I hear that right?
I thought it was going to be the 20 kids killed, but
I see.
I think we have a watershed here. Mm-hmm. We do, because now we have a president who has made some really vile comments, honestly, and he needs to get that attention off of him, and he has a chance to make some changes. If Democrats will work with this president and work together, we could get something done in this instance.
Paul, I hear Nancy referring to some of the language that President Trump uses on the campaign trail. And we've heard lots of cuts of that this morning on the news coverage. But she's saying that maybe this is the reckoning, his own reckoning, for the damage that kind of language does, and a possibility to work with Congress on this. Haven't we been here before?
Yeah, I'm just not sure why one would be optimistic about President Trump's dedication to gun safety at this juncture, as opposed to after the high school shooting in Florida, or as opposed to the horrific shooting in Las Vegas. And I certainly think it would be unwise to hold one's breath and expect that the president will stop demonizing immigrants, the media, and all of his other opponents in his public comments. I think, you know, for the extent of the day today, he'll be expressing his sorrow. But this is not going to change the man, I think, or the politician that is Donald Trump.
Chad says on Twitter, let's start with ending the Dickey Amendment and pay for the research. If I understand this, this is restricting money to go into research about gun violence in America. Is that right?
That's right. Congress has restricted the Center for Disease Control from doing certain kinds of research on gun safety. I certainly personally think that research on gun-related issues should be robust and prolific, and that that information should be widely disseminated. I'm skeptical that it will lead to changes in our this huge sociological and political problem we have that leads to these kinds of mass shootings.
Just to note what you said, I think this is important. You said, yes, we should be doing research on the consequences of gun violence and the contributors to gun violence, but you're not sure anything would really change in what's happening today.
No, I think it's possible that such research could undergird certain kinds of additional restrictions, but would such research lead the owners of the 300 million plus guns in private hands to turn them over and to be beaten into plowshares? I'm skeptical that it would have that effect. Our big problem in this country is the number of guns that are in private hands and available, sadly, not just to ordinary criminals, but to the mass killers of the sort we've seen over this past weekend.
Call here from State Senator Ron Latz, who wants to talk about gun issues in the Minnesota State Legislature. Senator Latz, welcome. Good to have you on the line. What do you want to say?
Thank you. Well, I want to say that we have made efforts in the Minnesota legislature to pass a background check bill in the form of permits to purchase and also the red flag bill. The permit to purchase bill is not a background check on every transaction of purchasing guns, but rather it's an annual permit that a person who wants to buy a gun sometime in the next year can go to their local law enforcement issuer, typically a sheriff, apply for the permit, go through a background check process to screen out those who have violent felony convictions who are otherwise prohibited under current law from purchasing or possessing firearms. And then if they wanted to go ahead and purchase a firearm in those private sales that are not covered by the current background check system, the seller would have to verify that the buyer has a valid permit to purchase. And there'd be a criminal penalty if they fail to do that and if they sell to someone without a valid permit. And it would not apply to all firearm purchases. It would apply to pistols or handguns. And it would apply to the semi-automatic military-style assault weapons. So it would not apply to basically hunting rifles, long guns. But the firearms that it would apply to are the ones that are most often used in gun violence that we're trying to reduce.
Senator, I'm aware that there seemed to be, at the beginning of the legislative session, some momentum for gun reform legislation. It seemed to fizzle during the session. Was that the fate of your red flag amendment bill?
Yeah, that was the fate. We tried to find abilities to get an amendment passed, and it was ruled out of order when we made that attempt. So we didn't get a direct vote on it. We didn't have any opportunities. And frankly, we couldn't get enough commitments from sitting senators to vote for it. There are a number that are remaining uncommitted on this issue, and I don't know how that you can stay uncommitted on these steps. We've come a long way from the days when we were looking to ban all firearms or looking to force every firearm transaction through a federally licensed dealer to tap into the federal background check. We've moved a lot in the direction that would protect Second Amendment rights. People who lawfully own firearms who don't have an already prohibited background would not be affected by this at all, except for an annual permit, which would be free.
Okay. Senator Latz, I'm glad you heard the conversation and you called in. I appreciate it. Paul, just because I know you monitor gun legislation across the country, does the description of what happened here at the Minnesota State Legislature, where we had a DFL House and a DFL governor at the time and a Republican-controlled Senate, is that often the way it goes if you look at individual legislatures?
It often is. The dedication of ordinary civilians, activists, and their political representatives who are concerned about Second Amendment rights and are therefore deeply suspicious of any kind of restriction on the acquisition or ownership of firearms or any kind of permitting system is not to be underestimated. And in my experience, is not affected deeply by even the most horrendous incidents. We had the 2012, mass killing in Newtown, Connecticut.
God, right.
First grade children, the president on TV shedding tears over it, and it really didn't contribute to any kind of groundswell of restriction. On the other hand, as we discussed earlier, we have seen some movement at the state level anyway, since the Florida high school shooting. By the way, Florida does have one of those red flag laws, which you asked me earlier, and I didn't know. So it's one of the 15 states. But, what your state legislator described in terms of there just being a fizzling, a escape of energy from behind gun restriction legislation, I think is quite common. And Minnesota is, a great laboratory for seeing that, a state that, has a strong political reform, political tradition, strong Democratic lawmakers. But there's still, a very deep and deeply felt tradition of owning firearms. And it's tough to get around that.
Paul, I really appreciate you taking the call last minute, as you do, and for your insight. And this was an enlightening conversation for me, too. Thank you.
You bet.
Paul Barrett is the deputy director of NYU's Stern Center for Business and Human Rights, and he's the author of Glock, The Rise of America's Gun. We're turning now to Jacqueline Schildkraut. She's associate professor of criminal justice at the State University of New York at Oswego, joining us from Syracuse today. Hi, Jackie. Good to have you on the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
We've talked to you in the past about how these shootings are covered. You've been doing some scholarship work on that, on this, and I know you have a piece that's going to be published in a journal soon, essentially in which you say the way the media covers these mass shootings is deeply problematic, too. Tell me why.
We see a very significant focus on the perpetrator in these events, and what that does is it really signals to other like-minded individuals that if they, commit a similar atrocity, then they're also going to get their name in lights. In many ways, it incentivizes these individuals, and that's not even something that we have to tell you from a research perspective. That's something that they're telling you from their own mouths. For instance, your previous guest mentioned the Florida shooting, and that's actually the community I grew up in. And that particular perpetrator left videos behind saying, I'm going to do this because I want my name in lights. So we're now rewarding these individuals for doing what they're doing, and we're incentivizing other like-minded individuals to do the same.
You know, what you're saying strikes me as especially important given the shooter's what's being called a manifesto. I don't like that word, but, what he has posted, the guy in El Paso, what he has posted on 8chan, they want notoriety. They want this kind of attention. So I don't think it's an insignificant thing to talk about the way the media is going to cover that. I mean, on this one, the cat's already out of the bag, Jackie. You see the wall-to-wall coverage and all this drilling down into the manifesto part of this. What could it look like if we took the research and we understood there's a better way to cover it?
You know, there's a phenomenal campaign that I'm proud to endorse and work for called No Notoriety. And it was started by Tom and Karen Keyes after their son Alex was murdered in the Colorado theater shooting back in 2012.
Right.
And, you know, the No Notoriety campaign, it's not calling for the media not to do their jobs. You know, there's viable information and valid information in all of these cases for us to learn from as a society in attempts to prevent future acts and to do better. But we can do that without giving identity to these individuals. You know, there's the reproduction of their manifesto by the mainstream media just should not be happening. Of course, we know that we cannot control what goes on the internet. It runs, you know, somewhat rampant, but there has to be a starting point where we say this hatred, this vitriol doesn't have a place in our society, and we shouldn't be propagandizing these messages. You know, that's what they're looking for. It's my understanding that the particular individual in El Paso, you know, there was a lot of talk about him being captured without incident. And that's not something you usually hear about with a mass shooter, you know, that they just go, okay, yep, I'm done here. I'm going to turn myself in. But in this particular case, he wants his day in court so that he can go and continue to spout his white supremacist, you know, rantings. And so by continuing to pull pieces out of his manifesto or, you know, share it in part or in full as if there's some sort of investigatory value for the public isn't really the right, you know, we're not all, you know, detectives. We're not all going to be able to find that investigatory, you know, value in that. And it's best left up to law enforcement. We saw a very similar push, you know, out of New Zealand with regards to the video that particular shooter
That's
made
right.
live
right.
while he was in the middle of his killing spree, which I've seen the video, and there is no value for the American public or any public to see that video. You know, Facebook had to take it down millions and millions and millions of time over, and I hope that they are doing the same, and other social media outlets are doing the same with this particular manifesto. So, we just unfortunately can't control the dark web.
So here's the dilemma, and I was thinking about what we were going to talk about this morning as I was listening to a story about this 8chan, this site that hosts white nationalists and white supremacists. You know, I knew that the minute there was coverage about it, how many people are going to 8chan to get a look at it for themselves. But there was really important information in the coverage of what this site does. And then we found out that it was taken down for a while, and then they found a new hosting platform. I mean, I feel like that makes me a more informed person to understand how the internet emphasizes and spreads this kind of hate. And I think I need to know that, but I can also see the downside of that. What do we do about that kind of ancillary coverage to this?
Well, I think that you raised an excellent point, right? That there is a way to learn about the methodology of how this hate is spread. But even in your very own description of that just a moment ago, you never said his name and you never said the contents of his manifesto. And so I think that you can have those discussions to say, what is the pathway of the information without highlighting and emphasizing the information itself?
By the way, I mentioned this 8chan, and I heard this story this morning on NPR, and we have a little cut from Robert Evans, who was in the piece, who studies online extremism, and I think this is valuable to understand.
The El Paso shooter directly cited in his manifesto, the Christchurch shooter's manifesto, as an inspiration. And you know, I don't think this attack happens without the other one. If 8chan was an Islamic extremist gathering place on the internet, it would not be around anymore.
Robert Evans from a piece this morning on NPR about 8chan and the role that it plays in online extremism. Let me grab a call here from Jim in Rochester. Jim, I really appreciate you waiting. I know it's been a while, but interested in what you have to say.
Yeah, that's fine. We're talking watershed moments. I have a personal theory that it's economic. Why so many young men in our country are turning to extremism? You know, what 8chan, you know, preoccupation, racism, and then this kind of extreme behavior. I feel it's economic. I think the American dream, American middle class, is too hard to achieve any longer. It used to be real easy, and I think that gets to kind of the core of the disenfranchised feeling with too many young American men these days. Just kind of a theory, and maybe this is a watershed moment that we could kind of take a deeper dive into why so many American young men feel disenfranchised. That's the essence of my comment.
No,
thank
Jim, I think that's really thoughtful. And the reason I wanted you to hear that, Jackie, is there's nuance in what Jim's saying. And by the way, I do think there's been some very good coverage that brings in elements of what Jim mentions and some of the other issues that we've been talking about. The problem, I think, is that's not the leading story often. It's what you're concerned about all the grisly details of how this unfolded and what this guy thinks. I wish there was more of a platform for the kind of nuance that Jim is talking about. Do you find that anywhere?
You know, certainly that nuance is happening in the academic community. You know, and I think Jim does raise an excellent point that ties in with the clip prior to that, in that he found, you know, motivation or inspiration from the Christchurch shooter. And what we see time and time again is that these individuals are studying each other. They're building off of each other. They're finding inspiration in each other. Mm-hmm. We can look back 20 years to Columbine and see that, you know, many, many shooters, including the Christchurch shooter. I have not seen the manifesto from El Paso, but many, many shooters reference back to Columbine. And here you had what started with Jim's point, two very disenfranchised youth who were like, you know, kind of screw mainstream. And so I think when you know, to speak to Jim's point, that, you know, the issue of disenfranchisement becomes all the more issue, because if they're feeling disenfranchised from not necessarily the middle class, but just society in general, mm-hmm. and then they're going to this world that's providing them validation, and that is a violent world, then that is a conversation that needs to be happening. But it also goes back to the bigger issue that we talk about mass shootings in a very one-dimensional note at any given time. You know, we can't seem to talk about multiple things at multiple times. And because of that, we're missing the bigger issue.
I just have to say, I don't want to let this moment pass because we have not talked about the rhetoric and the language that President Trump uses on the campaign trail. But when you say, then they enter this world where their extreme views are validated, it does have to be said that some of the things that the president says, not from the podium this morning, but when he's on at campaign events, must contribute to that validation that some of these people feel.
You know, I certainly think that we have seen a rise in the white nationalist sentiment over the last several years since our president took office. I'm not an expert in this area, and I'm happy to say that on air, and there are better people to speak to that than me. But, you know, I think that we have seen more, you know, a more outward showing of extremism than we have seen in previous years. I think back to Charlottesville, yeah. You know, with that event, and,
right.
you know, now with this particular shooter having more of a white nationalist sort of agenda, because realistically, if we look back at previous manifestos, if we think about people like the Virginia Tech shooter, who obviously was not, you know, a white person, or we think back to the Columbine shooters and sort of their line of vitriol, they just hated everybody. And it wasn't that they had this sort of white, you know, supremacy complex. They just had a godlike complex. And I think that that's a very different sort of narrative than what we're seeing now.
Yeah, good point. Call here from James in Minneapolis. Hi, James.
Hello. How are you today?
Doing good. I've only got a couple minutes, so I'd love to hear your thoughts as quickly as we can.
Okay. I agree with your speaker, Torboy. The media is a problem with this, whether it be social media or the news outlets, when glorifying some of these acts and perpetuating the ideas. And yet we must not hold President Trump accountable, hold the NRA accountable, hold guns accountable. People commit these crimes, and we need to look at how we control these people.
Okay, James, I'm going to put this to Jacqueline because we're short on time. What do you see an element of glorification, Jackie, in the kind of coverage we've seen and will see for the next few days?
Absolutely. You know, we hear far more about the shooters than we do about the victims, you know, and I think that that's really where we need to shift. There's, you know, there's a lot of victims that we don't even talk about, you know, in total. I mean, we talk about the people who were killed and the families they leave behind, and we talk about the injured, but there were hundreds, if not thousands, of people who were directly exposed to the two shootings between El Paso and Dayton, and their families and the communities at large. And then there's a whole collective network of people who have been previously impacted by mass shooting who are now re-traumatized, you know, because the club that nobody wants to be a part of keeps growing. But if I may, I do want to just say one thing to James's point, because I think he raised something very important.
Many apologies. I'm sorry we are absolutely out of time. Can we pick up the conversation another day?
Absolutely.
Thank you. Jackie Schildkraut with us from State University of New York at Oswego.
You just heard a recording of a live radio show from NPR News. You can add your voice to the discussion by calling in at 800-242-2828 or tweeting us at Kerri, K-E-R-R-I, NPR. To hear more conversations like this, subscribe to our podcast. And thanks!